Good afternoon, great people. My apologies for being late. I had a meeting that ran a little long. Thank you, everyone, for coming in, and we will officially begin our employee assembly meeting today, Wednesday, October 16th at 12:03 p.m. And Yvonne, I will pass it to you to do roll call.
Thank you, Erica. Hi, everyone. Good afternoon. We're going to go ahead and start roll call with if you are here, please let me know, announce yourself. Brian Arnold.
I am here.
Thank you. Mel Bonta.
Here.
Adam Blakesley. Frank Cantone. John Chang. Thank you. Carl.
Present.
Erica.
Present.
Bethany Dixon.
Present.
Jamie Doss.
Present.
Thomas Hambury.
Here.
Don Henshaw. Kyle Carnuda,
I'm here.
Ellie Crump Powers, Jeremy Cruiser,
Here.
you, Sophie Lanches, Yalverton Lucane. Christine Mahoney.
Hello.
Thank you. David McDermott.
Yeah, I'm here.
Pia Mengers.
Here.
Thank you. Anne Morse.
Present.
Stephanie Rasu.
Present.
Kate Supron. Deborah Serene.
Here.
Thank you. Wendy Treat.
Present, and also Don put in chat that he's here, and also Ellie Crum Powers is here as well.
Thank you, Wendy.
Yep.
Jana Van Houten.
I'm here.
And Danielle. All right. That is everyone. Thank you. Pass it back to you, Erica.
Thank you, Yvonne. And before we go into our land acknowledgement, I just want to publicly apologize for last meeting. I ended the meeting at 1 and I thought we were supposed to end at 1 and not 1:15. I was still on vacation brain. My apologies, everybody. I know now that we end at 1:15. But with the land acknowledgement, Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayokono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayokono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of the Gayokono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of the Gayokono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. And with that, do we have has everyone had a chance to look at the minutes for October 2nd, 2024? If not, it is hyperlinked in the agenda that was sent yesterday. If you all could take a couple minutes to review that, and then I would open the floor for a motion to approve October 2nd's minutes. Yes, Carl.
I just want to remind you that we also have tabled the September 18th minutes as well. So if we're in the same spot, or could put the link in the chat for those minutes as well, maybe we could acknowledge and approve those as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for reminding us, Carl. Eric, can you place the link to those minutes in the. Oh, thank you, Wendy. I welcome a motion to approve the October 2nd minutes. Do that first. Carl.
I second.
You have to motion and then have someone second, Carl.
Thank you.
Sorry, I thought she said she did motion.
I'll motion. The chair can't motion. Someone else has to motion and then someone else second.
Thank you.
Yep. Motion to approve.
Seconded.
Thank you. It's been properly moved and seconded. Is this by unanimous consent? Yes. Awesome. So those meeting minutes have been approved, and I'll give you about one more minute to review those minutes from September 18th. Okay. Is there a motion on the floor for the approval of the September 18th minutes? Carl?
I'll motion to approve the September 18th minutes.
Awesome. And Wendy?
Seconded to approve by unanimous consent.
Thank you. And it's been properly moved and seconded to approve these minutes by unanimous consent. And so we will be moving forward to the call for late additions to the agenda. Does anybody have anything they would like to add to the agenda? Okay. Seeing none, we will move to the business of the day. Meeting chat reminders. I do believe this was for you, Carl.
Yeah, so I wanted to remind you that chat is not a part of the official record, and we really want to hear your thoughts. So please raise your hand and be acknowledged to participate in the meeting. It really allows us to have productive dialogue. We also recognize that the chat allows for an optional additional opportunity for our members to connect with one another. We want to ask that all participants engage in the chat in a manner respectful to everyone to make sure that this is an option we can all enjoy. If we see participants not engaging with respect, then we'll have to limit this option for communication, and we'd rather not have to do that. So just be respectful to everyone there.
Thank you, Carl. And so moving on to our next business of the day item, we have our speaker, Gordon Barger, who's the Senior Director of the Benefit Strategy and Initiatives, who'll be sharing some benefit updates and some general information on the data breaches that we received information about. So Gordon, thank you for joining us, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. I can't believe a year has gone by. I don't get before you too often. Maybe that's good news, because it would not necessarily be good news if I was coming before you more often. But let's jump in quickly on the data breach. And I want to, forgive me if you know some of this, but I want to give you a quick data breach 101, because it's becoming such a part of our, unfortunately, weekly lifestyles here in the US. So there are some data breach regulations that basically apply to all vendors, employers, others who are holders of data. And this comes into play, particularly in the situations we're going to talk about. So if you are the holder or owner of data, so if you've been contracted to hold data, if you've been authorized to hold data, you take with that a responsibility on the security of that data. And if something should happen to that data, if you become aware of a breach of some kind, it is you as the data holder's responsibility to evaluate the impact, notify individuals as soon as possible of the potential impact, take caution and repair to however that data was breached, and then provide some kind of aftercare. And so anytime, and this is now kind of unfortunately far too often occurring accepted practice in the US, that if you become aware of data that you hold being breached, you have responsibilities. And that is the case that's happened to Cornell in two instances related to benefits in the past 6 to 8 months. So in October, well, we'll go further back. Actually, last August, the US was kind of announced in general, and then it started to get delved down, that there had been a major data breach in healthcare information that was held across the country. There's an organization called Change Healthcare, and Change Healthcare has been contracted with by physicians' offices, by insurance companies, by hospitals, to actually be the repository of medical insurance information or medical claims information that then can be accessed from a number of sources. So when your provider's office needs to confirm coverage, in many cases, they use some aspect of Change Healthcare to tie their databases into PUL records. It's kind of a scary thought, but we are no longer alone in our data, and as related to medical care, there really is a huge database that many medical facilities and providers need to access to ensure coordination, that there's knowledge about insurance. The fact that nowadays you can get an insurance response on a claim so quickly is in a positive way due to the fact that there is this major healthcare database, and Change is one of them. Unfortunately, what Change revealed last early fall was that they had been breached. It was not a malware attempt. It was an actual breach of their system. And at the time, it was unclear how much healthcare data had been released, but it included a database that had names and social security numbers and healthcare ID numbers and health insurance information, payment information. And so the Change organization had to begin their evaluation of who could have been impacted. Unfortunately, what we've learned, and Cornell was not, you know, our data could have been part of this just because insurance companies are in, your providers are in, your data could have been part of this. We were notified, as the rest of the country was, that this was being investigated. Unfortunately, the outcome of that investigation was not great news. It's now estimated that probably 1 in 3 Americans had their data breached through this Change Healthcare action. And again, not related to a particular insurance company, not related to a particular employer, not related to a particular physician's office, but in combination, a huge, huge breach. People started to get information directly from Change because they were obligated to communicate. Some people got information as early as last November. And we know that some Cornell individuals just started getting notification in this year. So if you think about the size of this population, they were reaching out as they could determine that there was a risk for someone. Now, they're not able to say to anyone, here's exactly what was breached on you, but they're putting out this notification that says you were likely part of a breach, which means there could be some financial risk to you. And so I want to stop there, and then I'm going to talk about the next steps, because I want to talk about the more recent one, which was Infosys McCamish. So for those of you who've worked with the flexible spending accounts at Cornell, or who have worked with New York Life Life Insurance or Voluntary Life, McCamish is a subcontractor for those benefits. They're, again, a very large database system for the U.S. for life insurance companies, for retirement investment companies. And they discovered there had been a malware breach sometime between October 29th and November 2nd of last year. Now, again, they're pretty huge. Unfortunately, the data repositories are really huge organizations now. They're very large. They involved lots of different benefit plans, lots of different organizations, lots of different employers. And so they too started their investigation on what could have been breached, who was at risk. McCamish was a little bit closer to Cornell because they are a biller for our New York Life. And so we were notified as an employer right away that there was employer aspects, but they couldn't tell us what had been breached at that point. So since November 2nd of 23, the initial reaction by Infosys McCamish is they shut down all of their systems. And for those of you who might recall, we were doing re-enrollments for guaranteed universal life to voluntary term life last year. And it was right in this window when people were trying to call McCamish Service Center that they shut down all of their systems. And so they did what many would consider to be the absolute correct response. They closed all systems. There were no integrations in or out. Information was very spotty that you could get from them. And they took the rather rare, but I think a really good response. They did not try to fix their systems. They rebuilt their systems completely. And that caused a longer delay, but it ensured that there was no breached, software malware that was still in their systems because they started fresh. Naturally, because they needed to investigate what might have been breached, it took them a little longer, and they started, as we know, communications out. And Cornell portion of this breach, our individual started to get communications in September of this year. When Cornell, because of our involvement, we didn't have an obligation to communicate, but because we knew it came close to home with our plans, we chose to do a blanket communication out about both of these breaches just because people could get either letter at any time. And we wanted to be helpful. It might have backfired a little bit on us because I think people thought we were somehow admitting responsibility. We are not. This was not our breach. It was not specific to Cornell data, but we wanted you to know that letters like the Infosys McCamish letter that many people were getting were actually valid letters. It's a third-party company, so you may not have known their name at all, but they were related to New York Life. It's subsequently been released that not for Cornell, but other companies that Infosys McCamish work for are investment firms. And so you may have retirement accounts somewhere where you would also get a letter from Infosys McCamish because you could be part of that breach. In response, both in the Change Healthcare and in the Infosys McCamish, the natural response that is given is some kind of speculation about data that could have been breached about you. And then in almost every case, there are free services offered for data security, identity theft, those sorts of things. Usually, those services are offered for a year from the time you enroll in them. And so individuals who got the McCamish letter also got information that they could reach out to a third party called Kroll Monitoring. It's an identity monitoring service. All of this is legitimate. They're working for Infosys McCamish. We know Infosys McCamish because they have a role in New York Life. So these are all valid communications, and that was the other reason for Cornell to send out its communication, was just to validate you could be getting these. One of the concerns is people got multiple Infosys McCamish letters, and that was basically them trying to be very comprehensive. They took any name or address that ever existed in their data files, and a letter was generated for each one. So if a file ever went to them that had your middle initial on it, and a file went to them that didn't have a middle initial, you would have gotten two letters. If you had more than one life insurance account, you would have gotten a letter for each account. So that became very confusing. We don't usually see that kind of response, but McCamish wanted to be very, very thorough. Each letter had a membership ID number in case someone wanted to take advantage of the free services and monitoring through Kroll Monitoring. Those membership numbers were unique to letter, not necessarily unique to person. So if you called Kroll with one of those letters, they could institute the protection across all of the plans that you had that were impacted. We've had a question about, what if you threw away the letter and you don't have that membership number? There is a contact customer service number at McCamish, and they can actually assist you to get you a membership number if you don't have one of those letters. And I'll put that out to the EA separately. Actually, I sent it, I think, but I'll send it again just to make sure that you have that in case you need to contact them. So that was my attempt to be short-winded on a little bit more about data breaches. I have to tell you, in my long career in this field, this is the saddest part of my job, that this is getting to be so common across the US. Data breaches and people wanting to see if they can get access, it's just on the rise. Luckily, I've not seen so many dire consequences of it, which doesn't mean they can't happen, but I would Without giving you advice or counsel, I would say if you ever get a letter about a data breach and you can validate that it's accurate, I would suggest you take advantage of any of the free identity monitoring services that are available. They also give recommendations about potentially freezing your credit lines for a period of time. It doesn't mean no one has access. It means you have to authorize someone checking on your credit, which is not a bad thing either. So that's kind of my, I said quick, that's kind of my shortened spiel on data breaches. Anything I didn't cover, questions that you'd like to know more about? Or should Gordon just stop talking about it? It's not been a fun time, I can tell you, since we were alerted. Okay, let me just check chat. Nope, okay. I will jump then into renewals. Let me share my screen. So hopefully you're all seeing a wide page picture. So once a year, I come to you to talk about the endowed side of renewals and actions for open enrollment for 2025 in this case. And so I'm back to do that now. And I want to kind of walk through our processing and what we do. We're going to talk a little bit about healthcare trends and then some other improvements and changes we're implementing 1-1. I'm sorry, hey, did you have a question?
Sorry, going back to the data breaches, I have been contacted by some individuals who had some confusion. Do you have any resources like write-ups on everything that you just mentioned right now in regards to those data breaches that I can share outwards if people had some questions about it?
So some of it was in my introductory email about you getting these data breaches, these data breach letters. I don't have anything exactly what I just said, but I think it's, you know, we can validate the letters. The important things, hey, is what the vendor tells you is what you need to act on. So each one is a little bit different in how you respond to them. But if it depends, if you can share with me a little bit more about what you'd like, I can try to write up something.
Okay. All right.
Or
I'll send it in an email. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay, so renewals, and I'll try to keep, if somebody else can keep me honest with chat, if I should stop on anything. Okay. Okay, so let's talk about where we are with active endowed medical. So we look back each year, 24 months of claims. We look forward on medical trend that we see is happening in the industry. We look at our potential rebates or discounts from prescription drugs, and we look at our population, their age, their demographic, where they're going, and working with outside consultants, we have an estimate of what we believe our spend will be in the following year. And again, based on the prior 24 months, we do some adjustments to that based on things like high cost claimants or any anomalies that we see. But in general, across our three Aetna health plans for 2025, we're expecting the overall cost to be going up 8% for 2025. And that includes medical trend, that includes what we're seeing in our utilization, that includes specialty drug growth, a number of things. We also, Cayuga is a major player, Cayuga Medical for Cornell, and they renegotiated a contract which basically added a lot more costs to Cornell's plans, to the student health plans, to others who use Cayuga. So that's been factored into that additional contracting. We also know that the deductible was increased for participants in the high deductible health plan. It was mandated to go up for next year. So that actually is a little bit more cost share for participants. We talked both about participant costs and Cornell costs. We have made a couple improvements about diagnostic oncology, but I will say, and I'll cover it again in a minute, those did not drive this 8%. It's really what we're seeing in medical trend and spend. let's talk in a little bit more detail. And I'm not going to cover all of these today, but there's some good news and bad news in what we've seen in the last 24 months. And I'm going to jump to some of the good news. So over here, if you can see my cursor over here, oops, let's not do that. The good news is 96% of adults in the Cornell health plans sought preventive visits and preventive screenings. And that's higher than Aetna is seeing for any of their other customers, their standard book of business. So that's great news. We're being preventive, really, really good. We've also had growth in size, which has an impact on our costs. We grew by about 3.5% in 23. We're looking at data 24 months. The clean data is really about through February, March of 24. We've got things securely in when we run these numbers. And so we're looking back 24 months before that. We saw a growth in covered people. So more hires, more people in the plan. That drives overall cost up. We still look at per member cost to see where we're going. We did see some national trends. So we saw across the nation increases about 6.5%. So when we talk about an 8%, that's medical trend plus what how we're using the plans specifically. So where our folks are landing. We do know that we have a slightly older population than a lot of our comparators, whether that's comparator Ivy schools or the rest of Aetna clientele. Higher ed usually has people stay longer, and so our participants are a little bit older. We do know that we're showing pretty common trends as far as where the most expenses go. Our top three areas of spend are musculoskeletal, so that could be nerve, bone, muscle challenges, behavioral health, as far as both doctor's visits, hospitalizations or drug use, prescription drug use. And then cancer is in our top three too. So oncology in those three, 11% of all of our spend is driven by just those three conditions. So we're seeing things like inflammatory conditions where you've probably seen all the late night commercials about Humira. Humira is a very, very expensive drug. And as we have more people go on to that drug, that's impacting our costs. Diabetes is another big trend for us, but we're also seeing people trying to expand into diabetic solutions for weight loss. So you've probably seen or heard about the Ozempics and the Wegovys, Trulicities, these drugs that traditionally have helped for diabetes now being used and prescribed for weight loss. We have some boundaries on how people can use these for weight loss. These are very expensive drugs. They're usually about $1,000 a dose. And so if you think about the more people we have going on these expensive drugs, that drives our costs up too. Cancer infusions. Again, cancer being one of our prominent areas, really going up. And then we always talk about and we always look at high cost claimants. And so high cost claimants for Cornell are people whose medical spend is more than $150,000 in a calendar year. We have more high cost claimants in the past 2 years than we've ever had before. Two claimants in particular, and we don't see names. I don't know what your medical claims are. I see across the board. We had two claimants that had more than $1 million in claims. And so as you think of us as a population of around 9,000 people on this healthcare coverage, if a few people have $1 million treatments, that really socializes across our plan and everyone sees a slight bump on that one. So those are just some factors. What does it mean for us? Well, we're talking about an 8% increase overall. And as you might recall, Cornell supports premiums at a pretty high rate. So for an individual on any of Cornell's plans, we charge you 10% of the total premium and Cornell picks up 90% of the premium. For families, the family portion of your contracts, we ask you to pay 25% of the cost for those families, and we pay 75%. So we have tiers. We have employee only, which is EE. We have employee plus child or children. They have a different expected cost for us. Employee plus spouse or partner. And then family coverage, which is two adults and one or more children. We also have unique to Cornell what we call dual coverage, which is if both parents are Cornell employees, we cut you a break in what you pay. But if we look at these trends, and we'll start with the Program for Healthy Living, we've got almost 7,000 contracts, almost 10,000 people enrolled in this plan when we count spouses, partners, and children. That's our most heavily enrolled plan. Currently, contributions per month in 24 for an individual were about $72. We do need to increase those costs. We're going to keep the share ratio the same. So both employee share and Cornell share is going up 8%, which means that if you were an individual in 24 and paying $72 a month, you'll now pay almost $78 a month, roughly 6% more. And that's going to include that 8% cost. Now that $5.75 per month that you're paying more is also pre-tax. So if you figure you're not paying taxes on that, it's actually net impacting you probably about 3/4 of that. So $4 and change. For employee plus children, the net growth is $26 a month, again, on a pre-tax basis. Employee and spouse is a little bit more expensive to cover, so that goes up another $2 over the 26. And then true family, and I realize this is painful, but it's just a little under $40 a month that it's going up on a pre-tax basis. Now, for those enrolled in our health spending account, those plans are a bit cheaper to offer. So the 426 contracts, so about 600 people who are covered by that plan, those you're going to see the range of increases per month run from about $250 to about $26. And keep in mind, the health savings account is set up so that you pay lower premiums, but you pay more as you go. When you use the plan, you're responsible for more payment. The WILD plan, our lowest enrollment, this is for the people who want to have the added ability to go to a select group of doctors in New York City at WILD. Those, again, increasing in the area of $10.50 roughly to about $58 a month for those plans pre-tax. So overall, Cornell is still paying almost 85% of the total costs of all healthcare. And basically, contributions paid by faculty and staff are going up about $1.8 million in total. Cornell's share is going up about just a little under $10 million in additional costs for next year. Increases are not good news. I know 8% is actually right in the trend market for across the nation. And we're still want to maintain as much as we can a share. Our goal for sharing costs, I mentioned, was sharing 10% with an individual and 25% for families. You'll see that we're not there. Cornell is actually supplementing much more than the 90% and more than the 75% right now. So, Kate, I think you were first with a question. Oh, you're on mute.
So, yep, I got it now. So the 8% increase, you said Cornell's cost overall is an increase for the Aetna plans is an 8%. Is that 8% per insured individual, because you also mentioned that the pool size has grown by 3.5%. So that's my question is that the total cost or the cost per employee?
It's actually both. So what we do, because what you'll see here is the total dollar cost. So we look at the cost per mm-hmm. family size projected out.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're slated to pay 90%. We're paying 92% of that cost and sharing the balance. So overall, if you look at total spend was $142 million in 2024, and we're expecting to be $153 million. So that grew by 8%. And because we want to maintain the 90-10 and the 75-25, even though we're doing more, we're taking that 8%, increasing our share by 8%, and every individual cell by 8%.
Okay, so almost what I was asking. So I'll try to be more specific.
Okay.
When you started talking about the overall cost, not the percentage increase, you know, like you're having us absorb, or Cornell employees are absorbing 8% of a change. My question was about when you said Aetna's cost has increased 8%, what Cornell has to pay Aetna. And my question was, is that for the total insured pool, it's increased 8%, or it has increased 8% per employee? Did the 8% adjust for the 3.5% increase of the pool, I guess was my question.
Yeah. So sorry, I thought I answered that, but let me, so
yeah.
We don't look at every individual and what they spent.
Right. No,
we look at total. So, yeah. But I'm going to get there, Kate, I promise.
Okay.
So in total, in 2024, we spent $142 million across everybody, all belly buttons. So we talk about doorknobs or belly buttons. So everybody in the plan, we spent $142 million. That included all the additional heads. So that was our total cost. For all those people, because we socialize, we don't look at an individual spend, we look at everybody's. Our spend, the total spend, is going to go up to $153 million. So that's an 8% growth.
Mm-hmm.
When we go back to the individual, because we look at tiers, we want to keep our cost share the same. Notice that you're only paying 7.5% either year, 19.2% either year. So we're applying that 8% growth on our share and every tier within. So we're not saying of that 3.5% more heads, they had some percentage of cost, because we're socializing all cost. We're not going to charge someone more because they spent more.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying, okay, the average cost per insured person
right.
is, I guess, what I'm asking, like the premiums
Is 8% growth. Is 8% growth.
But that also, am I correct then, includes the 3.5% growth of the population that's covered?
Yes. 8% includes everything that impacts our cost. So medical trend, number of bodies, actual claims, all included in that 8%.
So it feels a little bit like, because the employee pool has grown, the number of lives covered are growing. I feel like it seems a little odd that that is included in the increase in premium, because Cornell overall is paying more money to Aetna in premiums. But let's make it really simple. Let's say instead of 3.5%, a company is growing really fast, or Cornell's growing really fast, and we add 20% of more people to the pool. Would our premium go up to adjust for those people? Because if I'm hearing you right, the 3.5% increase in the number of belly buttons or doorknobs doesn't really feel like an increase from Aetna and what they're charging.
So, okay, Aetna's not charging us a premium. Let's get rid of that right away. We're self-insured. So Cornell pays every dollar. It's not an insurance arrangement. So Aetna doesn't come up with these rates. Aetna has administrative fees that are part of what we pay them, but we pay every claim dollar.
Right.
Cornell does. So this $153 million expected in 2025 includes all of our administrative costs, all the claims costs, any rebates that we're getting, and then we carve out of that the share that you're putting towards that cost. So that's this 153. In total, all the population, including any growth, is paying $23 million. So to your point, yes, we're having more medical claims, but we're collecting from more people too. So they're both factored in. It does even out, and that's this socialization that we have.
Okay.
So yes, what we're going to see is, and we'll see it, we'll have the same discussion for 26. These number of contracts will likely go up. We'll have people leave. We'll have people come. What we never know is if we're going to gain someone with a lot of medical needs or lose someone with a lot of medical needs. So in a way, it's evening it all out. We don't want your risk to be about your usage. We want the risk to be socialized. So all these factors, medical trend, how many lives are covered, how healthy they are, all of that factors into this projection of the extra $11 million. Does that help?
Yep, thank you.
Okay, good. Hi, Wendy.
Hi, Gordon. Thank you again for coming and presenting. We appreciate it very much. I just have a quick question. Do you have any information or details about those of us that are on the contract college side of things? Not the endowed side of things.
Yeah, sorry. And I should have led with that. So contract college, as we know, is controlled by New York State. The medical plans they have cover hundreds of thousands of employees. And so they have not yet released where their trend is or what their prices are going to be. We normally get that in November, and then they give us their option transfer window. So we have to follow the state for that. Sometimes you may recall it's happened all before January 1. Sometimes that option transfer goes into January, depending on how quickly New York State negotiates their contracts. So they have more vendors than just one. We're lucky to have Aetna and Optum. They negotiate across all these lives for all of them, and they have not set their rates yet.
Can I ask a really quick follow-up? Do you have a sense of whether, I mean, I'm guessing more than likely contract college will also see an increase. Do you have that kind of sense as well?
You know, we don't see the data, so I would really only be guessing. I'm going to say that if we think about medical trend across the U.S. being 7 to 8%, I would be very surprised if they came in under that. Now, their cost sharing is a very different model. And so how that will impact the HMOs versus the Empire plan, they make all those determinations, but they have a huge buying power too. So, you know, their number of lives keep the costs. We haven't traditionally seen huge increases year over year, except for really bad years for the nation. But I would expect that their costs are going to be right around 7-8% growth too. Not that their contributions will be exactly that. Our, you know, our calculations for that are very, very different. Kit.
Always great to see you. I wanted to circle back on, I think, Kate, what you were talking about. And I work in finance, and I think I have this correct. I might not. But my understanding is the cost, I think the concern, or what I'm sensing the concern was, is that the increase in the employee pool would pose, an increase in the cost for the employees, like just based on the sheer fact that Cornell has a larger, employee population, that means that we would be paying more in healthcare costs. And I believe, Gordon, where you were coming from, and I, from what I understand from a math, I shouldn't say math, I'm not great at math, I'm good at money math. When it's, let's say Cornell had 10 people and it was averaged out. Let's say Cornell only had 10 people and it was a socialized cost. Someone coming in with very high cost, healthcare costs, that average would go up really high for everyone, for those 10 people that work at Cornell. But because Cornell has such a large population as it is, it's the amount of change that it could or could not be is so negligible because Cornell already has such a large pool that it's kind of like, if you say, you know, if we're saying 50% of new or 50% of new hires are going to come under the average cost of our existing employees and 50% are going to come over. So I think it's an averaging question.
I think you've hit right on it, Kit. I would add one other aspect just to think about. So it also matters if those new hires are singles or if they're enrolling family members, because we have risk. So we look at, and Kate, maybe this would have helped. I should have said it before. We look at total costs. We look at per member per month costs. So we look at members. And so we look at here we're talking about contracts in the second column. That's, you know, that's doorknobs, that's households. We also look at members though. So one doorknob could have five members, and we have to look at the claims for those members. So while headcount at Cornell has gone up, it could have gone up on singles more, and we could have had more families terminating or retiring. So that's why it's really our risk is by every member, not by how many new hires we have. But Kit, your point is really well received too. It's total bodies. So as Cornell hires more, we have more risk for expense, but we're collecting more too, because we're equally charging everyone.
Before we move on to Tom, we have about
I need
25 more minutes left in our entire meeting. So we want to be able to get through the things that we have scheduled for today as well as much as possible. But Gordon, we want you to be able to get through your presentation as well too. So we are going to end the questions after Tom. And if folks need to ask any follow-up to Gordon, we would ask that you reach out to him directly.
Absolutely. Tom, you're on the spot. What you got?
Okay, this is kind of like being the last speaker before lunch break, you know, or before the bar opens. This is a quick, and you and I can talk about this offline. Okay. This says obviously deals with endowed active. What's the story on endowed retiree medical?
So I have those as a slide. I didn't think we'd have time, but obviously we do all of that too, and that's already gone in. The good news on our retirees is for our pre-65 retirees, a relatively small group, they were having a no increase going into the next year. So when we calculated costs and their spend, and remember that group, the longest they're in that group is 10 years if they leave us at 55, because once they're 65, they go into one of the other plans. On this particular page, you're going to see a very scary numbers of 21% and 29%. Retiree costs are actually much lower. And so when we think about what a 29% increase is for them, we're talking about for the 80-20 plan, $10 a month for an individual and $45 a month for a family. So we were pretty consistent, even though overall cost is going up, that their cost share, and they're truly at the 10-25 now. Actives have gotten a little bit of a better benefit over the years. So in total, they're paying about $3 million more. I'm sorry, $500,000 more, and we're paying $3 million more for retirees. So they've got not a bad year. Again, we tend not to look at 21%. We tend to look at dollar increase.
That's a pretty big group, though.
Well, 1,100 people. So Medicare Advantage is a little bit of an anomaly because of how they work with Medicare. Maybe we should talk about this one offline a little bit more, but there's a lot of differences with retirees as far as where their spend is, and that Medicare is picking up the primary.
Right. You've answered my question. Thank you.
Okay. Sure thing. Sorry, folks. I'm just going to cover a quick couple things here. Some good news. We did also negotiate some savings that are helping us for next year. So we got a service fee reduction of about $270,000. We're getting a new health allowance that is going to help us annually by about $400,000 to help us do some offset to expenses that would normally go against the plan. So we're trying to keep costs down where we can. Two important things that we're adding that did not drive that 8%. I just want to be really clear, but these are the right things for us to do. Oncology, I mentioned, is one of our highest spends. And so starting in 2025, we want to encourage more diagnostic and preventive care. We offer preventive cancer screenings like colonoscopies and breast imaging right now at 100%, no copay. We're expanding that in 25 to be also diagnostic. So once you have the preventive screening, if you need follow-up, we want you to get the diagnostic screenings. So now those will be covered at 100% also. And so we'll talk more about that in open enrollment. We want to really start to address where future spend could be and how we can help people to get treatment early. So this is I think a very positive bump up. The other thing we talked about last year, we started working on family formation. We're adding one other little perk in that area that we just didn't have last year. In order to help all families form, we know that lives change, needs change. We've always covered sterilization in our healthcare policies. We are adding the reversal of sterilization so that if a family decides that they want to create, if an individual decides they want to create a family, we're now allowing for that to be a life choice just as it would for others. The other thing I'm just going to talk about, because we'll come back and talk more about these things, we've as a university really started to look a lot at behavioral health and where we can have inroads and help there. I mentioned behavioral health expenses are in the top three expenses for the endowed plans. So we're looking, the important thing on this slide is there's four areas you can adjust: access to care, how you get to that care, how easy it is, the affordability of that care, and then how you address what's happening in the workplace that could keep people from getting that care. So we are looking at all four of these areas with work life, with our plans, and you'll hear more about that probably in the next month or so about behavioral health in particular. Yes, Christy.
Thank you. And maybe it's not for now, maybe it's another meeting, but that triggers for me the impression of what's happening in our local medical environment, mm-hmm. Difficulties with access, changes in Cayuga Med's offerings for pediatric care at the hospital, things like that, that really impact the experience we have. We have the benefits, but then we have this experience side. And I would love to understand what Cornell is doing, either to partner or otherwise encourage consideration of our community in their decision-making. So if we could table that for another time, I would appreciate that.
Absolutely. And if you wouldn't mind, if you can just send me a little email, a little bit more info on the pediatric care. I'm certainly aware of the access challenges for behavioral health, but just if you can give me a little more background on what's happening with pediatrics. The last thing I'll quickly leave you with, because I like to talk about endowed across the board, MetLife Dental, the two plans that we offer, the standard and enhanced. We did have a cap in place on how much they could go up. We had a number of years of no cost increases. These plans are being really well utilized. We're really grateful for that. People are saying they're really appreciating the plans. Unfortunately, that does result in, these are insured products, and so MetLife, the insurer, does need to raise their costs a little bit. I again hate to use percentages because they're confusing sometimes, but overall the cost increase is 4%. You'll see that starting in 25 per month, the cost is going up anywhere on the standard plan from $1 a month to $3.75 a month, and on the enhanced from $1.82 to $6 a month. Again, never good news. It's all pre-tax. If that increase is helpful, keep in mind we're somewhat of an outlier, a great outlier, in that our enhanced plan gives you $5,000 worth of benefits a year. So it's a very comprehensive, very full plan. But you may choose in a given year to not need as many services and maybe move from enhanced back to standard if the costs here are preventive for you. The other thing is our vision program. The great news for 25 is we negotiated a no rate increase on that one. So same costs for vision. The last thing, sorry, I said that was the last thing. The last thing I'll put your heads out about is you will get mailings. Some of you will get mailings in this fall. We have negotiated that for anyone not currently enrolled in life insurance, We are going to do voluntary life insurance. We're going to do a one-time guaranteed issue that you can get into it. You can get in with no questions asked, no medical questions asked, for up to 5 times salary, capped at $1 million. And there's going to be a window of time to do that from the time we announce through the end of the year. So if you're not currently in the voluntary term, it will be a new open enrollment opportunity for you. Everyone else can opt, who's in it, can opt to increase the coverage, but they do have to go through medical insurability. For our non-enrolleds, we've got this another opportunity for in with no questions. And that's my very long presentation. A minute before I needed to be done. Maybe I took up all your time. I hope not. You got 16 minutes. I'm giving you back 16 minutes for your other important business. I'm happy to come back anytime you'd like me to, and continue discussions or talk about new topics. So please let me know how I can assist. For now, you're going to start to see open enrollment materials probably in the next couple of weeks for Endowed, and again, probably not until November for Contract College.
Thank you so much, Gordon.
Thank you. And send me questions if you got them. Thank you.
All right, great people. So we will move on to our divestment referendum option here. Yvonne, I think you have more information around the divestment referendum.
Yes, so I know that we had had conversations about this in the past, and just kind of bringing up that the student assembly had passed something similar last year, and just kind of wondering how people were thinking about this. Is this something that us as the employee assembly want to continue to have conversations about and potentially support? So before I share any additional information, I would like to hear people's thoughts. Yes, Dave.
Hi. I think it's a terrible idea. I strongly oppose any movement to divest from our endowment or whatever you want to do. Today, Israel is being attacked on three sides from Gaza, Lebanon, Yemen, and Iran, and the criminals are in those countries. So if you want to divest from Israel, I just think it's terrible. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Any other thoughts? Yes, Allison.
Not a yay, but nobody else was raising their hand. So, is it to divest from Israel, or is it also a military contracting kind of military company? Kind of a thing also. I can't remember where that was, or is it TBD?
Thank you, Allison. Yeah, so for clarification, the divestment is not necessarily directly with Israel, rather with weapons manufacturers who Cornell has investments in. And so that's kind of, and now are they connected to Israel in that part? You can, I guess, make that assumption in that sense.
Thank you. Yeah, I personally feel like there's very little that I can control in how my money, like my investments, sometimes it feels like it. Maybe there's more I could do if I did more research, but I would greatly appreciate not making, considering, I guess another clarification question. Is this Cornell's endowment investments, or is this like our retirement investments, or is it both, or is that also TBD?
That's a great question. It becomes rather complicated that I don't know that I can answer that question. We do have a speaker for our next EA meeting who hopefully can provide that information a little bit more clearly so that we can all understand what is going to be impacted if this is something that we want to or not support.
Thank you. I welcome any opportunity to not be making money toward my own, wealth, from weapons manufacturing companies and other, I have other things on my personal list, but that's a big one for me for sure. And I'll stop going on now that there are other hands. Thank you.
Before Kyle goes, sorry. I just want to make sure as far as like EA representatives that this is something that if you are unsure how your constituency is feeling about this, that you, this is something you take back to them to understand if this is a employee issue and not just a personal issue, right? We don't want to conflate our own personal feelings about the issue with what our constituency would believe as well. It may be advantageous for us to take this to the folks that we represent.
Yeah, that was actually my exact question, Erica, was what is the purpose of today's conversation? Is it meant to be, I think we've had this conversation individually, like I think we know where individuals in the EA stand on this issue. So is the referendum a vote amongst us as individuals to move forward with some particular step, or are there some action items and some language that we should be taking to our constituent groups? Like how serious is this conversation right now?
Yeah, I think this is really the opportunity. The reason why it's on the agenda today is to understand where our constituencies lie with this, right? So if folks have been having any conversations with their constituents around referendum or have been brought things, right, about a potential referendum or issues around divestment, to see if this is an issue for the EA at all to even, you know, start the conversation about how to develop a referendum and or resolution around this. So if no one has talked to their constituents about this at all, then that may be something that we need to put out to the ether just to see how folks are feeling. And if this is not an issue for employees, then we'll know better when we can come back and have this conversation and say, hey, did anybody have any thoughts back from their constituents about divestment at all? Kyle, your hand's still up, so. Did you have any follow-up?
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I'm sure it's incredibly mixed across everybody's constituent groups. And I think when we talked about this before, there was a need for more information. And I think Allison actually raised some good questions. So I think it's a serious enough question. We know the nature of this conversation. It's going to provoke a lot of emotional responses. I don't think it's even something I'm prepared to have a serious conversation with my constituent group about this until I've got some very clear direction on exactly what we're asking them and have some facts to back up both sides and et cetera, et cetera.
Absolutely. Thank you, Kyle. Brian?
Yeah, this is a good follow-up to where we just left, because I think the more information we can gain on the subject, the more constructive this conversation is going to be. And I think it's very difficult I think it's very difficult to not have an emotional response to it, because I think there are situations in the world today that we all have very strong feelings about. The one thing I do want to add to this conversation, I think all of us in theory know that Cornell gets a lot of its operating budget from federal grant funding, right? So if we get $20 million for research from the National Endowment for Health, the university gets to keep 60 to 65% of that off the top, so that the rest of it, 8 million or whatever, if that 20 million goes to the actual research project, the rest goes to operating costs. By far, the biggest federal granting agency for research is the Department of Defense. And the Department of Defense also allows Cornell to take a higher percentage of operating costs than a lot of the other federal granting agencies. So I think that's going to be an incredibly difficult idea to bring to the table and get support from the upper administration. That's all I have to add.
Okay, Danielle?
I just want to, in terms of the, is this our thing to think about? When President Kotlikoff was on, he made a point to say that, yes, the students overwhelmingly passed, I believe it was a resolution, Marcy's specifying in the chat. I don't know the difference. Students passed whatever that they passed, but without corresponding votes from Faculty Senate, without corresponding votes from Employee Assembly, from all the groups, that there would be no movement on that. So I think in that regards, we are kind of a cog in the system, whether we think we are or not, because our participation it has to do with the facilitation of anything being done. If we decide we don't act, then nothing happens regardless.
Thank you, Danielle. So just as some context before we get to Tom and Wendy, the Student Assembly did have a new resolution that they tabled indefinitely, meaning they are not going back to it with regard to divestment. And if we aren't able to have all five assemblies agree toward a resolution for divestment, then it won't go to the Board of Trustees. However, that does not stop us from creating our own resolution or referendum if this is a matter that is impactful to the employees on campus enough to create one. It just wouldn't go to the Board of Trustees for review. Tom?
Yeah, just a quick note. Frank Cantone and I are the, just so everybody knows, are the retiree representatives, and we share a seat. And so that's why you typically only see one of us at the meetings. But the point I want to make is it's not easy at all, or maybe even possible, for us to contact our constituent group. We can't go out to, you know, the thousands of retirees at Cornell and poll them about what they think about a very complex topic in any easy way or even at all. So my sense, and I'd have to talk to Frank about this, is on any vote, we'd probably abstain.
Thank you, Tom. Okay. Wendy?
Mine is a two-parter. I also wanted to echo what Tom just said. As the exempt employee representative, I really don't have a good means to get in touch with all exempt employees across campus to find out what their thoughts are on this. The second part of my comment is I would like to put forth a motion to extend the meeting by 10 minutes so that we can finish the rest of the business on our agenda.
Is there a second?
Second.
And if you are in favor of extending the meeting for 10 minutes, can you react with the check mark? Marks. All right. If you are not in favor of extending the meeting, can you react with the red X?
As a reminder, only EA members should be voting.
Okay, and if there are any abstentions, can you please use the slow down reaction? Thank you. Do we have a tally here?
That was 10 to 3 to 1, 10 to extend, 3 to not, and 1 to abstain.
There should be 2 abstentions, myself and Sean.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I didn't see you. Actually, it blends in with the wall really well on my screen. So there are 2.
Okay, so I understand that folks may need to go at 1:15. So if you do need to go, please go to whatever else you need to go to, and then just review the meeting recording. All right, so we are extending our meeting until 1:25. All right, and so I think that was all of the feedback for the referendum. So we will be having Kenneth Miranda, who's our chief investment officer, coming to our November 6th meeting. And that is something that he is going to talk to us about, like what investment looks like, what divestment could affect for us, if at all. And so that may be the best time to get the information that we were looking for in order to be fully informed, or at least more informed than we are now, about how we would take this to our constituents for those who have the means to do so. Okay, awesome. So moving on to our next agenda item, EA committees and membership update, that would be from Wendy.
Yes, so I'm about to put a link in the chat of a document that I created that has all of our internal committee composition, who's on it, who's not, you know, where there might be gaps. Again, just as a reminder, our standing committees, with the exception of the elections committee, have 11 voting members, 6 from the EA, which includes the chair, and 5 non-EA. So I would just kindly ask that all chairs of committees look at the composition. Let me know if I've missed anyone. Christy, you need to designate who your voting members are, because you have a plethora of people on your committee. And then also with the elections committee, again, it's just a reminder that anyone that's on that committee is an EA member. Seat is not up for election in spring 2025. But yeah, if you have any questions, let me know and we can go from there. Yeah, Christy.
Wendy, where did you pull this information from?
I actually pulled it from documents that we had from last year and what I could find on the Employee Assembly website.
Okay, and the best way to get that updated or modified?
You can send it to me. I'm actually going to be working with the Office of the Assemblies to make sure that committee membership and composition is all updated, whether it's Eric putting it in or Eric putting it back on me to make sure everything is updated on the website.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome. I was going to say, Christy, I think there were some on yours that I was like, I'm not sure if those people are still there.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you, Wendy. And then we have parking at Cornell. Yvonne, I wasn't sure if this was something that you had. Oh, Carl.
Just because we're running low on time, can I motion to postpone this to next meeting?
Yes.
Second.
Awesome. Okay, so we have moved and seconded. Is that by unanimous consent to move this to next meeting? I'm seeing some nods. Awesome. Okay, so we'll table the discussion about parking at Cornell until next meeting, and then we'll go into committee reports. So Yvonne with the executive committee.
Hi, everyone. Just a reminder that we're hosting the first EA sponsor coffee, co-worker coffee on October 30th at the College of Veterinary Medicine. From 9 to 10:30 a.m. Wendy, myself, and a couple other folks are going to be there. If you are able to make it, you are welcome. You are invited. Please come out. And we're going to be making an advertisement and sharing it with you all as well. If you can do us a favor and help us advertise it as well, so we can reach more people. And then the next one is going to be December 5th in Adelphia Hall. And we'll share more information as we get closer to that event as well.
Thank you, Yvonne. And our next is communications, but I think Don had to leave at 1:15. So we'll move on to the Employee Education and Development Committee.
Hi, everyone. So our committee met last week. Finally, we were able to meet and we came up with a great list of ideas. It's kind of a long list. We're going to review it again at our next meeting, which we're going to meet every 2 weeks. So I'm hoping, for sake of time, I won't share some of those ideas now, but I hope to share them at our next meeting. Thanks all.
Awesome. Thanks, Deb. And Employee Welfare Committee. I think Christy had to leave, but if there's anyone from the committee that would be able to provide an update.
We talked about parking, as usual. We talked about, beep went off and I got ADHD distracted here. We talked about the parking. We talked about whether or not it was necessary to move forward with the statement regarding the strike. And that was the primary that we focused on in the meeting.
Thank you, Danielle. For Benefits and Policy Committee, anyone here who would like to report back? I think Bethany needed to go. Okay, so Bethany needed to go, so I don't think we have anyone from benefits and policy. And then Stephanie also had to go, but she said there's no new updates for elections committee since our last meeting. So with our last couple of minutes here, 6 minutes, does anybody have anything for open discussion at all?
I just wanted to do a pulse check. I know since we last met, we had this really lively conversation about the protests, and there have been some updates. That graduate student that we had spoken about sounds like they're able to, while they're still banned from campus, they're still able to, they're no longer at risk of losing their student visa status and can finish their studies. With regard to the bigger issue of protests on campus, and I want to make sure I have a good read on the different perspectives. From a facilities perspective, staff are literally cleaning up the mess of the protesters, and there's some dislike of that. There is some support for some of the institutions that were covered in the divestment resolution. From a student and campus life perspective, staff have to explain policies and work with students on how to navigate peaceful protests and dialogue. From a broader level around staff's perspective on protests and the place in higher and its place in higher education, what I've heard is that where students are experimenting with their beliefs, this is sort of the place to do that. If it is safe, if it does not result in destruction to property, but where we create unsafe environments and we destroy and create, disruption, harm to property, it sounds like that is unacceptable. But in the absence of those things, it seems like generally there is support of protest, but I want to make sure I am understanding the different perspectives as well. If there is anything anybody wants to mention to me, email to me, feel free to do that, because I think we only have maybe 5 minutes left and I don't want to take up all the time, but I do want to be sure that I understand the different staff perspectives on this, so I can speak to it, keeping in mind that board meetings are this week.
Thank you, Hey. Kyle?
Was the university assembly meeting, did that happen already? And if so, were there any updates regarding the law about providing free menstrual products?
The university assembly meeting does not occur until the 29th. So,
okay, I jumped the gun. Nothing from me.
No worries. And Eric.
Hey, everybody. Just a quick update. I know that Don had to go from communications, outreach, and recognition, but one thing we have is the George Peter Award is now open for nominations through November 10th. So I'm going to put the link in the chat right now. So if you have someone that you would like to nominate, please go ahead. And as always, if you have any questions, just let me know.
Thank you, Eric. Any last things for open discussion? Danielle.
Not open discussion, but liaison report. The faculty senate meeting was last week. Some of you may have read about how well that went over, and it sure did. But the primary topics of conversation were the part-time online bachelor's program, whether using suspensions punitively was appropriate, and also kind of more of the general expressive interim policy and concern from faculty on increased surveillance and lack of transparency.
Hey.
I have a question about that. I believe there was also a resolution asking for Joel Molina to apologize for some of the comments that he had made. Yes. I wasn't sure if any other individuals had some thoughts on Joel Molina, who is technically, I suppose, a staff member, but also in light of some of the commentary that he had made, are there any perspectives from the staff in regards to that?
The faculty had strong opinions. I know sitting in on that meeting, because he specifically said, which was out of keeping with our own rules, that the individuals who were reinstated would be closely surveyed basically, and that raised a lot of concerns with faculty over academic freedom. I don't think a lot of the staff are in the loop on it, so I don't know how much of an effect it has. I think it's more of an academic freedom thing for faculty.
Does anybody else have any feedback to provide to Hey Hey or any other open discussion items in this last minute we have here? Okay, well, seeing none, I want to thank you all for staying through this extension of the meeting, and we will end our employee assembly meeting today, Wednesday, October 16th, 2024 at 1:24 p.m.
Do we have a motion to end the meeting?
Oh, sorry. Motion to end the meeting. Do we have
motion to adjourn?
Yes, motion to adjourn. Yeah. Is that you, Wendy?
Yes.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Awesome. So we will actually, it's been properly moved and seconded. Is that by unanimous consent? Yes. Awesome. So we will end our meeting today, October 16th at 1:24 p.m. Have a good day, everybody.
Bye.